Oh, no.
Good afternoon. Welcome back to the House Committee on Transportation and Economic Development. Wednesday, March 27th, we're going to start with the work session on House Bill 2345 that we carried over from Monday. And Troy, you've done some good work in uncovering what transpired to lead to our confusion. I think you've communicated with most of us individually, but just on the record and so that we're all clear. What happened on Monday, please?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I will recap what happened on Monday with regards to the legislative fiscal impact statement. Each of you received an email from me. I can't remember if that was yesterday afternoon or this morning, but that was from legislative fiscal, which summarized the sequence of events, the timeline, and everything like that. So I believe everything has been answered, if I'm correct.
So essentially, we had a legislative fiscal impact statement that was updated between the time we had a hard copy and what was electronic. So the electronic one is the more up-to-date version, and I think that was a lot of our confusion, is the fact that it was updated between the time. This is the downside of working in real time and on electronics. Representative Cameron?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Troy, thank you for your great work in trying to get those things answered. It was about the process, and I understand that. And are we in a work session?
We are.
Okay. So it was about the process, and obviously a little conflict in two different statements that we saw in the process. And I understand a little clearly a little bit more about what the bill actually does. I still have a concern about answering, and this isn't only about this bill, but when an agency comes forth and says we're going to use existing resources and just move those, my thought is, okay, where are we taking those resources from, and what is not going to get done as a result of moving the resources over here? And it's interesting to me that whenever we want to do something, we can find a way to do it. When we don't want to do something, and you know, I've had this discussion about a bigger issue here that's a customer service issue to the people of Oregon. If we really wanted to do it, we'd find a way to prioritize our resources to make it happen. And so I thank you for letting me say that and get that off. And sorry to slow down the process, but I'm glad we caught it and fixed it. Troy, thanks for the good work.
My pleasure, sir. Anytime.
Appreciate the comments, Representative Cameron. And of course, I can't speak to every bill on that, but I can. We do have Tom Reinhart from the Treasurer's Office here if we want to talk about the specifics in this bill and how this task force would work relative to the other things that the agency does. So that, I'll leave that to you.
Tom came and saw me. I said, we're good.
Great.
And we can move forward.
Okay. Yeah. Very good. So we have the we have the Dash 3 amendments in front of us. That's what we were talking about the last time we had this bill open. Representative Betts.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 3 amendments to House Bill 2345.
Thank you. Representative Betts has moved the Dash 3 amendments to House Bill 2345. Is there any discussion? Any objections? Seeing none, the motion is adopted, and the Dash 3 amendments are adopted. You'll remember that pending the Dash 3 amendments being adopted, which we've just done, we did receive a letter from the Speaker's office rescinding the subsequent referral to Ways and Means. So we are now ready to move the bill to the floor if we choose to do so. Representative Vince.
Chair, move House Bill 2345 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Benz has moved House Bill 2345 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendations. Is there any discussion? Any objections? Seeing none, motion carries. House Bill 2345 goes to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Unless anyone objects, I will be happy to carry the bill. We'll close the work session on House Bill 2345. Thank you very much. And let's stand at ease for just a moment.
Batwoman right there.
That's called bipartisan.
Too late. Daily routine. Back to order. Whatever it was you were doing.
I was changing their diapers.
Okay. We're going to open a work session on House Bill 2453. Troy, if you could remind us the summary of this bill, please.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. House Bill 2453 requires persons operating certain high mileage motor vehicle to pay per mile road usage charge or flat annual road usage charge. Becomes operative July 1st, 2015, permits person paying per mile road usage charge to apply for refund of motor vehicle fuel tax. Permits person paying per mile road usage charge to apply for refund for miles driven on private property. Directs Department of Transportation to establish methods for reporting vehicle miles traveled. Provides penalty for taking false statements related to payment and reporting of road usage charge or collecting, attempting to collect, or receiving refund to which person is not entitled. Punishes by maximum fine of $2,000, creates offensive tampering with vehicle metering system, punishes by maximum fine of $2,000, requires department to enter into agreements through Oregon Innovative Partnerships Program to undertake transportation projects related to operative of road usage charge system, takes effect 91st day following adjournment of sign and die.
Thank you. So we have as a couple things to remember as we get started in the discussion here. One is that if this bill moves from this committee, you'll note on the agenda it has two subsequent stops in the Revenue Committee and the Ways and Means Committee. So keep that in mind. Second, we have two amendments to discuss, and dash ones and dash twos, I think. Is that right?
Yep.
Very good. And Mr. Witte, if you wouldn't mind joining us and helping us understand the certainly the amendments, and we might have some broader questions, too.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is James Witte. I'm manager of ODOT's Office of Innovative Partnerships and Alternative Funding. The Dash 1 amendments replace Section 9 in its entirety. Most of the original Section 9 is still retained in the amendments. There's three basic things the amendments do. One, removes police officer access to personally identifiable information as part of the road usage charge enforcement. And the reason for this is that there is no enforcement to the language involving police officers in the bill. So it's really inappropriate or untimely to have that language in the bill at this time. And later on, if there's a reason to have police officer involvement in the program, should this bill become law, we'll come back with that and deal with it then. So it's just an untimely part of the bill now. The second thing it does is limit the exception for disclosure of personally identifiable information only to those people who in the scope of their function in the program. So that's a bank doesn't have, who does payment, doesn't have access to travel patterns. So there's no reason to have that access, and so you restrict that by limiting the access to this information to those who are required to perform a particular function in the system. And then third, the requires that location and daily metered use records to be destroyed within 30 days after payment processing, dispute resolution, or non-compliance investigation, whichever is later. The bill currently has no destruction requirements, and so this is an additional requirement. There are exceptions for retention of aggregated data after removal of personally identifiable information, and then also when a registered owner or lessee of a vehicle consents to record retention. And then a third, also for monthly summaries of metered use by vehicle. So basically the bill payment records, you can keep ODOT and we'll be able to keep those. ODOT believes that these are good amendments. They strengthen the privacy provisions, and that's an objective that ODOT and the Road User Fee Task Force had in writing this bill. If somehow we miscalculated and the operations of the system are impaired somewhere, we'll be back and say offer some suggestions for correction. But right now, we think we've got it. I think this is a better privacy provision than Section 9 that's in the bill now. ODOT would urge adoption of the Dash 1 amendment.
Thank you. And are you in a position to help us explain the dash twos as well, or should we ask Mr. Strauss?
I would prefer that you ask the Betsy Strauss of ACLU for that, because ODOT has no position on the dash twos, support or oppose. We're neutral on them.
Understood.
They simply don't affect operations under the program.
Okay. Thank you. So let's see if there are questions on the dash ones and the bill generally, and then we'll get to the dash twos.
Questions
on the dash one amendments or the bill generally while we're here? Representative Davis, Representative Parrish is just asking if there are questions on the dash one amendments or the bill generally while we're here.
Can I just double check which bill we're on? I'm sorry.
No problem. We're on 2453.
Okay.
Reduced charge.
I don't have questions right now.
Okay.
We just very good. Thanks,
Mr. Chair. Representative Gorsuch.
It's on the bill in general.
Yes.
I do have one question for you. Can you remind me again why we picked the number that we picked for the vehicles that were involved?
55.
Yes.
Oh.
Yeah. Sorry, I should have been more.
Which number were we
Where are we now? Why we picked that overall 55 number?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gorsuch. 55 was chosen because for two reasons. One, it kind of an alignment with the national standard for that the federal government reached agreement with of the automakers for fuel efficiency improvements. They set the standard, it's called the CAFE standard, corporate average fuel economy standard, at 54.5 miles per gallon in 2025.
Okay.
And so 55 is just above that number. Basically says that vehicles that are highly fuel efficient and will exceed that number will be in the system. The second reason is that the task force wanted to start with a small set of vehicles. This is a new program, and you want to make sure it works. And if you start with tens of thousands, it could run into trouble starting the system. So with 55 level, you're going to have a few thousand to begin with in the first year, and a much more manageable system.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Any other questions, Mr. Witte? Thank you. Please take. Oh, we do have one. Representative Cameron.
Yep, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Witte. There was in the previous iteration, and I don't see it changing here. We didn't. We still excluded certain vehicles sold during a certain period of time. Correct. In the dash twos.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cameron, this only applies to the 2015 model year, and that section is towards the end of the bill. Let's see, section 30.
Yeah. Okay. Just to clarify, please. So from 2015 up, so if you have a vehicle today, 2014 model, that's 55 miles or more, you're excluded from this today.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cameron, the way the bill's written now, that's correct.
Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Let's see. Thank you. Please stick close. We may have more questions. Ms. Strauss, would you like to explain the dash two amendments, please?
2013. Chair Reed, members of the committee, Becky Strauss here on behalf of the ACLU of Oregon. Just want to briefly give my thanks to Mr. Witte for the conversations and the engagement on the dash one. We are in support of those and really appreciate the work that he put in to move those forward and for your consideration of the committee. I just want to briefly talk about the dash twos. As Mr. Witte mentioned in regard to the dash one, the provision about law enforcement access for compliance is coming out for now, mostly because there isn't a compliance enforcement structure in place with the system as a whole, so it seemed like it wasn't needed. With the dash two is coming in, authority for law enforcement to access the records with a warrant. So that was a protection that we thought was helpful and necessary. The objective here is to say we're collecting a bunch of information about people, innocent people, including location information tracked by GPS for the purpose of a mileage tax, and the intention is to put in a safeguard so that it's not used for another purpose down the line without the typical standard that our law enforcement agencies use, which is probable cause of criminal conduct. So that's the dash two. And thank you for considering it.
Thank you very much. Any questions for Ms. Strauss? Thank you very much. So we are in work session, and once again, the bill, if we move it forward, goes to the Revenue Committee and to the Ways and Means Committee before it does anything else. If there aren't any other questions or comments, I would be interested in the motion. Representative Benz.
Mr. Chair, I move the -1 amendments to House Bill 2453.
Thank you. Representative Benz moves the -1 amendments to House Bill 2453. Any discussion?
No.
Any objections to the motion? I don't see any. The -1 amendments are adopted. Representative Benz.
Mr. Chair, I move the -2 amendments to House Bill 2453.
Thank you. Representative Benz has moved the -2 amendments to House Bill 2453. Any discussion? Any objections? See, the -2 amendments are adopted. Representative Gorsuch.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I would move that the bill be sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation and then to the Revenue Committee by prior reference.
Thank you. Representative Gorsuch moves House Bill 2453 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the House Committee on Revenue by prior reference. Is there any discussion? Representative Nathanson and then Representative Parrish.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When we were talking about this a year or two ago, or maybe both, one of the issues that I asked about at the time was how the formula was developed. And frankly, I can't recall what the Oregon Electric Vehicle Association has said about this latest iteration of the formula. But I'm still wondering if there isn't some fine-tuning that could happen. And I hope that the Revenue Committee would take this up as a topic. For example, when we think about the impact of, there are a couple of things we're trying to make sure that vehicles are paying their fair share, if we're talking about fair share. A bicycle is placing less impact on a road surface than a car, but a very, very small car or a very lightweight car has a lot less impact on the road surface and deteriorating the road deterioration rate than a very large heavy vehicle or truck would. And so that's why there are different weights and different rates and different sorts of calculations. And when I see that we have a pretty simple formula in front of us and it's based on an average number, it looks like 35,000 miles, I'm wondering, was that the right formula? Should it have been just one condition or one criteria that's taking into effect, or should it be a little bit more sophisticated formula, such as class of vehicle or weight of vehicle? I don't mean exact weight, but, you know, certain tiers. For example, lightweight, heavy, or different classes of vehicles, instead of only simply this average of 35,000 miles that is the basis of the large part of the formula. So I'm hoping that this can be still considered and discussed, and the Revenue Committee will work on that.
The good news, Representative Nathanson, is that you are, in making your comments, you're talking to three members of the Revenue Committee as well. So we hear you, and I measure your complaint. I've thought about the committee as well.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Parrish.
Thank you. I guess I've got kind of a couple causes for concern, and not because philosophically I don't think a car should be paying their fair share. You know, the first is the model of how the test came about, and I know several of you participated and some other folks participated. That's not necessarily as qualitative as I would personally like it to be, and I say that because the people who participated in the test are kind of brand evangelists, right? I mean, they're going to be, they're moving that direction, they're buying those types of cars, they are already kind of an evangelist to where that technology is going. And so, you know, products and marketers face this quandary all the time as they're looking at new products in terms of, do you bring in a focus group of people who are evangelists to tell you that they like your new flavor of whatever cereal, and then you get it to the store shelf and market it, and it's really not that great of a flavor of cereal after all. And so, you know, in the marketing world, they have learned to weed out people who would be their evangelists so that they can get better data. And I just struggle with the fact that because a small handful of people thought this was great, that translates out into somebody with a car in rural Oregon. The other piece, or anywhere for that matter, the other piece of my concern is the scalability of the collection of money. And particularly if the thought is that we're going to rely on taxpayers to send us a check. Representative Gomberg got up today on the House floor in his remonstrance and spoke to the fact that we have all this uncollected income tax revenue. So are we looking at switching to a model where suddenly we have uncollectible gas revenue or mileage revenue or fees or whatever for the roads? And nobody has given me really good feedback yet that this can scale and be successful in the revenue collection side of it. We've heard that the pay at the pump kind of part of that option wasn't necessarily successful. So if we're relying for somebody to write a check, you know, and here's your statement, like it's a cable bill, I'm not as convinced, that people aren't going to first move to feed their kids, keep the cable on, and the gas check or the mile check that they owe the state of Oregon isn't the last thing on their list. So I've got some heartburn with this.
Thank you. Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I want to begin by thanking Mr. Witte for his hard work on this. It's been amazing to watch over the past 5 years, 6 years, the effort he's put into this most necessary piece of legislation. I'm going to be a no vote today based upon the fact that, notwithstanding his attempts to move heaven and earth, the folks in my district are still challenged with this concept. And I went during the Christmas break and met with a series of different people to see how this would play, and it never played well. It always played badly. And I initially blamed that on folks just not wanting to pay their fair share. But after I received a letter from one of my constituents with 12 different negative points in it, all of which I'm familiar with because I've worked with Jim on this, I realized that, and these are folks that are heavily involved in our community, and they pay attention, they read everything, they're knowledgeable folks. And they are strong leaders in the community. And they're, notwithstanding my use of every argument that has been fine-tuned and refined by ODOT, those folks were not persuaded. And this led me to understand that the biggest issue here isn't making the few thousand folks that should be pay. The big issue is, what are we doing to make sure that the folks in Oregon understand the need to address this issue? Because it needs to be addressed. And this I've been impressed with how Jim and others have done their very best to figure that out, but it hasn't been figured out yet. At least it hasn't soaked into the folks I deal with back home. And so, not wanting to be the tip of the spear and go back and explain why, because I've already tried that, and sadly it didn't work. And so, to me, that means we need a bigger effort. I've heard some suggestions about a four-state effort that's being discussed might be the way to do it. But I want it clear that this is a really excellent effort, but it almost seems like what we ought to be doing is trying again to float yet another much more aggressive trial balloon explaining the incredible damage that's going to occur to our roads if we don't get this fixed. And nobody wants to hear it, but that's what needs to be done. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Benz. Representative Gorsuch, and then Doherty, and then Dennis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First off, to the amendment that deals with the concerns with ACLU, I certainly can understand that concern from your organization. We've had a number of situations where law enforcement has actually been allowed to place GPS devices on cars without a warrant. And so I think that safeguard that's been put into the bill is actually quite necessary so that we can help to avoid that. We shouldn't have those sorts of things going on unless there is probable cause and there is a warrant. So I'm glad to see that. The second piece has to do with the 55. And I'm glad to hear you say that it was based on a federal standard rather than Oregon pulling a number out of the air. But I have talked to people who do still feel that, you know, that it, right at this point, at this juncture, as the president once said, that it is a target in terms of the only group of cars that can hit the target are electrics. And so, you know, I certainly understand that concern. I am going to vote for the bill, but only because we're not going to stay there, that this is part of a growing group of vehicles that'll hopefully eventually everyone will be under it. But I do understand that issue, and if we weren't going to continue on and include more vehicles, then I may not have voted for it. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Gordy.
First of all, just those who don't know me very well, I'm kind of a skeptic by training, and I was on the road user task force and as part of the sample of people that used were part of the test. And actually, I was not of an evangelist going in. And so I think the assumption that everybody was just on board with all of this, I think, might be a little misleading, because there were a lot of us that were skeptical going, how's this going to work? And how are we going to be billed? And how are we going to do this? And those of us that have been working with this for a year or two, and some people longer, that was kind of my skepticism. But knowing the process that we went through during the committee meetings, I know that Representative Benz was involved in a lot of those, and the tremendous discussion over what is the formula going to be, you know, for the road fee. And it was long discussion and back and forth and this kind of thing. And so, you know, from my skepticism, it was something that was coming out. And one of the big discussions is, again, how are you going to collect the money? You know, my good Irish Catholic upbringing, I figure everyone will be honest and will just pay it. But apparently that's not the case. So there were lots of different ways that people were going to do it. And I was on a system where I was billed through my credit card, you know, I paid with my credit card. And I was impressed with, first of all, the accuracy of the miles, because I left the state a couple of times, and that was indicated on the GPS. And they went through and they figured out how much gas I had used and how much I would have paid in gas tax and what the road user fee. And it literally was a wash between, and I have a hybrid, so I have a little higher mileage car, but I was impressed with that sort of thing. And then, again, the tweaks working out on what the payment plan would be, but I was impressed with the simplicity of going through and doing it. And then also in the discussion, realizing that, you know, we're looking at something that is a finite resource. Gas taxes pay for our roads, period. There's just no ands, ifs, or buts about it. And that revenue is going down and will continue to go down with cars that are more gas efficient. So I was just impressed from the day I went on this committee that Oregon was so forward thinking that we're not going to think until we get to the point, oh my gosh, we've got so many hybrids and electric cars, we don't have enough gas tax, we're looking that far ahead. So I was very impressed with that. But I was skeptical, you know, with the pilot project, and that skepticism went away after we were done with that.
Thank you, Representative Doherty. Representative Davis.
Thank you, Chair. I'd like to start by just thanking so much the members of the Road User Task Force. Clearly, you guys did a lot of work. And the work, I want to return to what's the problem that we're trying to address and the really important work that the task force did. And it's stated very nicely in Mr. Witte's memo to the committee presented at the public hearing, which is this. The policy of Oregon's entire road tax and use system is that each motor vehicle on the system should make a significant contribution for road use. And currently we have about 2,000 vehicles which aren't making any contribution. I say that because right now that 2,000 is essentially de minimis in the context of the number of vehicles. And the solution we have for current vehicles fueled by gas is a highly efficient taxation system. It's not perfect, and no taxation system ever will be, but it's highly efficient. Consumers don't see it. Most of them don't know it. That, frankly, is a great way to charge people for the use of the road. So we have a problem. We're going to have a growing number of vehicles that need to pay for roads. And I'm really thankful for the Road Use User Fee Task Force for attempting to find a solution. The reason I'll be a no vote is because I feel like the solutions that have been proposed create more problems than they solve. Create a very complex, labyrinth-like taxation system for what is effectively a very small tax collected from each individual. So I have concerns, like Representative Parrish has raised and others have raised, that from a very practical level, the solutions proposed will not work. The glimmer of hope in this, and it's not a glimmer, it's a reality, that every single state has recognized this is an issue. And I believe and I hope that we can seek a multi-state solution, because I do believe as a small state, if we get too far ahead on this, larger states, especially California, Texas, which have huge numbers of vehicles, and they will find a solution, and like many things in this country, their solution will be adopted by many other states. I think the best course is going to be seeking a multi-state solution. And so within that, my commitment as now a member of the Transportation Committee on the NCSL is to work with NCSL, is to work with those states to try to find a solution that works. But it's sadly, I'm going to be a no on this, because I just feel like the solutions proposed create more problems than they solve.
Thank you, Representative Davis. Representative Cameron.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Among other things, there's I believe the flat rate is at 35,000 miles is way too high over the average person. I'd just as soon see constituents be able to pay when they register their vehicles at the DMV and be done with it. But I have to declare a potential conflict of interest as a managing member of a limited liability company that owns a property that receives revenue from an EV charging station. So I just want to put that on the record.
And Representative Cameron, as you remember, given our new rules,
I have to put that in writing. That's the Greenlick rule, not our new rules. Sorry.
It's the House rules we voted on.
He's still dancing.
Thank you. Anyone else? There's only two people who haven't spoken yet. I'll give you a chance if you want to. Lively, your hand went up first.
Sure. A couple things. One, I have long admired the state for being an innovator and leader, frankly, and I see this as an opportunity to do that. And while I recognize the minimum impact currently from the standpoint of the number of vehicles, I truly believe not just these vehicles, but others, when we're looking at how we're going to finance infrastructure in the long term, we've got to move to a different model. And I think this is a time, frankly, to start doing it before we have a larger number of vehicles, and also just to test the system. Because I'm not convinced that the gas tax over the long term is going to be the primary source of how we fund roads. And so from my standpoint, the sooner the better that we start testing and finding out what the tweaks are to the system and how we do it, the better off we are. And from my standpoint, I would like to see Oregon lead the charge rather than waiting for somebody else to do that.
Thank you, Representative Lively. Representative McEwen.
Thank you, Chair Reed. And the beauty of being last is almost all of the important points have been made. But I, too, want to thank Mr. Whitty. I wasn't privileged to this process early on. I'm new. But there have been discussions about this, I know, for a while that I've been privy to, and I appreciate the good work that the committee did and that Mr. Whitty did in bringing this to us. I guess I agree with Representative Lively in the fact that we are being innovative, and we are starting something that maybe other states can replicate, and I think that puts us in a very unique position. I also appreciate Co-Chair Bence's comments about his district. I come from a rural district where there are not a plethora of electric vehicles. We don't have a lot of charging stations to get from my community 120 miles into the coast is challenging if you have electric vehicles. So I'm in a little bit different position, and my constituents is all over the map on this. There's a little bit of support from people who care deeply. There's a lot of, I guess I would call it, a lot of people just don't care because they don't know a lot about it. And then I have those that think any kind of a taxation system has some negative connotation to it and would be in opposition. So I have kind of a varied constituency. That being said, I will be voting yes for this bill. I think it's important that we address the fact that gas taxes are diminishing. We have to take care of our roads. I think our infrastructure is critical. We need to invest in it. And I think we're on the right track and beginning to make a transition, as we are doing in a lot of things in this state, towards a new way of doing business. So I will be supporting the bill and thank Mr. Whitty for his hard work.
Thank you, Representative McEwen. Before we take the vote, I just want to make a couple of comments. One is to echo the the thanks that have already been expressed repeatedly. This is an enormously complicated issue, and even if we move this bill forward, it has a number of other stops, and even if it moves out of the legislature, we're clearly not done with this issue, as I think everybody, regardless of how they're going to vote, would agree. I appreciate the fact that we're taking this on, and I particularly appreciate the thoughtful conversation we've had today. A lot of good points have been made. It's clear that people have been thinking about this and spending time with the bill, and that's very good. I do want to make clear, as I try to every time we talk about this, for anyone who might be listening and might not be as familiar with the concept as we are, this is not an addition. This is an alternative to the gas tax. A number of people I've encountered have gotten very upset, saying, now you're going to make me do this too. No, this is an alternative. This is you would be paying one or the other, not both. The bill includes a number of choices. We've talked in a lot of references to GPS. That is a potential part of this program, but it's at the choice of the driver. It's not something that's going to be imposed on people. That's very important, too. And the last thing I want to mention, a number of you have talked about a multi-state effort. I don't think what we may do if we adopt this this bill is at all in conflict with what I understand about the potential multi-state effort. I'm very supportive of that. I hope that they'll be complementary as that goes forward. So appreciate the good conversation, Representative Davis.
And I just want to add one more thing. I had mentioned that I'll be a part of the Transportation Committee for NCSL now. In our Denver meetings coming up in May, we are going to have a session on methods for paying for our road system, and I'm sure this will be a large part of the discussion. So I'll be excited to come back to this committee and tell you what other states are doing and what solutions are being found elsewhere in the country.
Perhaps we can have an informational meeting where you present the results of your fact-finding trip.
I could Skype in from Denver.
Maybe we'll work on that too.
And Co-Chair
Representative McEwen.
Just one more comment. I don't want to leave this this hearing with people thinking that we are not moving forward down in Coos County. We did recently build a brand new fire station, and we have an electric vehicle charging station built into the fire station, so you can come to Coos Bay and charge a car.
Very good. Well, I'm sure it's on the map, too. Very good. Thank you. With that, I think we're ready for a vote. Would you please call the roll?
Representative Cameron?
No.
Representative Davis?
No.
Representative Doherty?
Yes.
Representative Lively?
Yes.
Representative McCowan?
Yes.
Representative Nathanson?
Yes.
Representative Parrish?
No.
Representative Benz?
No.
Representative Gorsuch?
Yes.
Representative Reed?
Aye. And the motion carries. The bill goes, it's on to the floor and to the Revenue Committee with a due pass recommendation. We'll close the work session on House Bill 2453 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2195.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. House Bill 2195 provides that physician or health care provider may at any time report to Department of Transportation that person's a cognitive or functional impairment affects person's ability to safely operate motor vehicle without regard to whether report is required by department, provides civil immunity for report made in good faith. Mr. Chairman, we have both the fiscal, the revenue impact statements.
Thank you. We have Rich Hanson and Amy Joyce signed up to testify.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Amy Joyce from the Department of Transportation. Going to sort of tee up this bill a little bit with just some background on what's called the at-risk driver work group, and then if I may turn it over to Mr. Rich Hanson, who was a member of the work group and can talk about the bill and the recommendations and the good work that group did. Medical eligibility for a driver license and reporting requirements for medical professionals have been part of Oregon law for over 60 years. In the late 90s and early 2000s, the program went through a fairly significant change after direction from the legislature to ODOT to assemble a group to work on recommendations to improve the program. And so, again, through legislation over a couple of sessions and extensive rulemaking with expertise in committees that made recommendations to the department, The at-risk program evolved to a two-pronged system of both mandatory reporting and non-mandatory reporting to try to identify folks who perhaps should no longer be driving motor vehicles on our public roads in Oregon. Part of that was that the premise for advising that a person should no longer be driving moved away from a specific diagnosis or a single event and went instead to a determination that a person has functional or cognitive impairment and that that impairment is both severe and uncontrollable, and those terms are very specifically defined in administrative rule. I'm happy to get into that if you would like. Primary care providers were determined to be mandatory reporters for folks who they determined met particular standards, had to report to DMV, and DMV would take particular actions based on whether those standards were met. In addition to that mandatory piece, there's a non-mandatory or voluntary program in which really anyone can report to DMV that they believe a person, due to cognitive and or functional disabilities, should no longer be driving. DMV takes slightly different actions in that voluntary realm because of the difference of the quality, really, of the reporting. And DMV also employs several medical review officers, medical determination officers, who are medical doctors who will review reports, gather information, and assist DMV in determining this very important decision about whether to revoke a person's driving privileges based on these standards. In 2011, the legislature passed House Bill 3185, which was a direction to assemble a work group of very particular professionals to analyze the existing at-risk driver program, to look at some very specific standards and things where the program might progress. And the work group came up with a report, and one of the items suggested in the report, only one of them requires legislative change. There were a number of administrative changes that were recommended. Mr. Rich Hansen, again, was a member of that work group and is here to speak about that recommendation for legislative change.
Thank you very much. Sir?
Chair Reed, Vice Chairs Benson, Gorsuch, and members of the committee, thanks for this opportunity to be here today. My name is Rich Hansen, and I am a driver and traffic safety education consultant at DTS Consulting. And I was a member of that at-risk work group over the legislative interim. We assembled under Mandate HB 3185 in 2011, and it had nine professionals that were part of the work group, and awesome professionals, I might say. I just had the privilege of working with extraordinary professionals committed to conducting a fair evaluation of the issues, developing recommendations that were fair, data-driven, reasonable, and cost-effective. Some of the members of the committee were Dr. Sumathi Devarajan. She's a professor of geriatrics at OHSU. Dr. Catherine Wild, professor of neurology and psychology at OHSU. Mr. Jim Ilg, chairman. He was our chair of the committee and is an occupational therapist at Salem Hospital. We had AARP involved. We had Oregon State Police, Mark Davies. We also had research and program expertise from ODOT and those people. Dr. Barney Jones, Cheryl Anarud, Bill Merrill, and Rod Rosenkrantz. We're all part of that group, very, very supportive. We met four times in Salem and to identify the objectives of HB 3185 and review materials and arrive at our recommendations. So our task was to analyze evidence-based driving assessment tools and whether any of them would identify drivers at risk and who should no longer be driving. And some of those examples were age-based renewal and testing and the increased cost associated with such a program, a summary of evidence-based screening tools for medically at-risk drivers, and then a study conducted by DMV of all of the medical healthcare providers in the state, physicians who were part of this and their thoughts and ideas. And the summary of the work is indicated by the link. You can see it's the link on the testimony there. I would strongly recommend you take a look at that. It is extensive. And the ODOT staff and DMV staff were phenomenal in summarizing and pulling all those pieces together. So you can see the five recommendations for the top, or the four. That the program's working well and as it's currently designed, but it can be improved by making it easy for people to voluntarily decide to retire from driving. A big discussion was held there about trying to facilitate the retirement so that it was done with honor and respect for people who were either aged or infirm. It also provided further education to medical professionals. We found that some of the medical professionals in the response to the survey didn't have enough information about what the medical reporting piece was, and so therefore some more education was going to be prescribed. Do not implement an age-based license renewal or testing requirements. We found that it was not cost-effective, and that it also was not, it didn't reduce the benefit wasn't recognized, and so therefore was more work for not a lot of return. And then the standards of mandatory reporting from uncontrollable impairments to persistent impairments. And that was important because uncontrollable might be episodic as opposed to persistent was something that was continual and happened repeatedly. The fifth one, provide immunity from liability for those healthcare providers who report a patient to DMV when not covered by the mandatory reporting requirements. Currently, as Amy mentioned, only primary care providers are required or mandatory reporters. Neurologists or people outside of a general practice are not required to report and therefore don't fall under the immunity piece or the from civil liability. So this bill gives that opportunity to let them report without fear of being sued because they happen to report that this person might be medically at risk for driving. And it expands the reporting group. That's an important piece because we also talked about the fact that there were a lot of people who didn't see a PCP very often. They might see a chiropractor, they might see somebody else who might be able to recognize that there might be some kind of impairment and therefore needed to get some, be reported, and so therefore expanded to that. So we worked through all the pieces and were awarded with the knowledge that Oregon's program is a model for across the country. We really did see that we are doing a really good job. Because the decision to take away someone's driver's privileges is based on a functional and cognitive deficiencies rather than specific diagnosis. It used to be a belief that if one had an epileptic or seizure or something of that nature, automatically had their license revoked. And now we're looking at more of the cognitive and functional deficiencies. So I commend this bill to you as one item among many to improve the already well-operating and successful program. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Hanson, both for your testimony and for your service in the group. We appreciate
thank you.
It.
Thank
you. Other questions?
Representative Davis.
Thank you, Chair. And thank you both for your testimony and for your work on this. I really appreciate it. I want to clarify a few things. I imagine we will be moving this bill in regards to legislative intent. On line 15 through 17, do you have the bill in front of you?
I can get it. Do you have it? Do you have it right there? Okay.
Okay, page 1, subsection 2A, lines 15 through 18, the deleted language. That subsection 2A, that it, can you confirm, is that the section for mandatory reporters?
Yeah, take that.
Chair Reed and Representative Davis, right, that deleted portion is the existing law that grants immunity to only mandatory reporters.
Okay. My concern, my concern is the immunity language has been deleted from 2A. I read 2A, even with the deleted language, as requiring adoption of rules designating physicians and health care providers for mandatory reporting. With the language this deletes, my concern is that immunity from civil liability could be seen as being deleted from those mandatory reporters, because I see subsection 5 as adopting allowable reporting for non-mandatory reporters. Subsection 5 then has that immunity from civil liability for reports made in good faith. So maybe you can comment on my comment and if you think that makes sense or what the legislative intent is.
Chair Reed and Representative Davis, I believe that the intent and I believe the way it's written, but I could be wrong, you know, takes that piece out of the earlier portion of the bill, puts it into subsection 5, and by the way it's written, for both mandatory reporters and non-mandatory healthcare professionals who report, immunity is granted. That's how I'm reading that section, and I understand that to have been the intent of the work group. Perhaps Mr. Hansen can...
You're correct.
Let me make sure I understand that,
yeah,
too. It's the intent of removing it from a place where it applies only to mandatory reporters and putting it in a place where it applies to a broader category.
Chair Reed, that's correct.
Okay. I would follow up.
Please.
Sorry. I would suggest revisions on page 2, lines 3 and 4, that would say, if the report, whether made under subsection 2 or subsection 5, is made in good faith, the physician or healthcare provider is immune from civil liability. Because I still see some textual ambiguity, even though I think the intent is clear of what we're trying to get at. So, for the committee's offering.
Understood. Thank you, Representative Davis. Representative Nathanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to talk for a minute about the term medical professionals. On line 9 of the bill, provides a definition. It's section B. Healthcare provider means a person licensed, certified, or otherwise authorized or permitted by the laws of the state to administer health care. We are steeped in the desire to integrate behavioral health and physical health as we roll out healthcare transformation, and we understand the linkages between behavioral and physical health. And in fact, there was an incident down in my area, a very unfortunate incident, that involved someone who was having what might be called behavioral health or mental health issues, very severe. It ended quite drastically with the shooting death of an officer of the law. But this person, as I understand it, had also been driving a car erratically, and people had been fearing for the children who lived nearby because of some very aggressive behavior driving the car. The reason I'm asking all of this is that person, I'm guessing, had not been seen by a physician, as defined here in the prior section, Section A, may not have seen a physician, but had been seeing others who were delivering some sort of care. Would they fall under health care provider? It wasn't a nurse practitioner, for example. Wasn't a physician assistant. What does health care mean anymore, and how broadly can that be defined? And I noticed there's an occupational therapist that was involved in the work group. Would that person be covered, or is that person already licensed as a physician, for example?
Chair Reed, Representative Nathanson. The intent of the, at least my understanding, the intent of the work group was to expand the coverage for reporting so that it could touch base with people just as you described. I think the big concern was that, for instance, our chair, Jim Ilk, was talking about, you know, he sees people, but he's not a mandatory reporter, not a voluntary reporter, and he has to work with the physician to make the report. And so he would say, and, you know, he said that it would be great if he could be directly reporting that. And so, but to do so puts him under civil liability at this particular point in time. And so he, you know, that was the intent and discussion of the group.
Follow up? Well, I applaud the intent. I'm concerned that someone may say, well, that person, some sort of a counselor, let's say a trained counselor, that's, quote, just a counselor, not a health care provider. Have we gotten any sort of a recommendation or a ruling on how healthcare provider, that term, will be interpreted? Is it a term of art? Is it covered elsewhere in the statutes? I want to make sure that people are protected appropriately even if it's something someone else may say, well, that's not really a health care provider, that's a, you know.
Chair Reed and Representative Nathanson, I'll start out by making sure we're talking about just the immunity piece here, right? So certainly anyone may report, and typically, you know, those the non-mandatory folks are other medical professionals, law enforcement, family members, that sort of thing. But so then we get into the immunity piece and adding it to all healthcare providers. My understanding is that the work group and then in the drafting of the legislation shied away somewhat from ticking off different names of types of healthcare, because as soon as you start doing that, you're going to miss something, or there'll be a new development with a new name of a classification, and now somebody is outside of that. So my understanding is that it was drafted or left, because that is existing statute, broad to encompass it as broadly as that term can be considered. But that's my take on it.
Chair Reed and Representative Nathanson, one of the things too that's important was that the two physicians that were on the committee talked about there's a hesitancy to report for myriad reasons, but the major one is that it's a huge issue of independence and freedom and that sort of thing, that once you start, once you do pull a trigger on that, you start a process that has them go through evaluation and that sort of stuff. So I think in this particular case, there's probably less reporting that goes on that probably should go on. And the other reason, too, they talked about is that it's patient-doctor relationship they're talking about, that they want to maintain it and they want to keep. And they want to keep working with that patient, and so some would actually turn away from those physicians because of that reporting. So they're hesitant to do that. They work with the family instead and try and have the family work through that particular process. Or even some of them were talking about entering into contracts, or not contracts, but an agreement with the person that when they go home they won't drive anymore. And so they don't even go through the mandatory reporting. And that's where we wanted to try and get into the voluntary surrender and retirement piece, that we wouldn't have to even bother with that. So that was part of the discussion.
Thank you. Representative McEwen, and then my...
Oh, thank you, Chair Reed. First of all, I want to compliment you on the way you're presenting this very sensitive issue. And I've heard the words honor and respect, and I appreciate that greatly. This is a very sensitive issue for a lot of families. But it is a public health and safety issue, first and foremost. And I've been through this twice in the last 3 years, once 3 years ago and once 3 months ago, so I'm intimately familiar with how the process works or should work. And I guess one of the questions I have is, are you in under the implementation of this legislation offering training for those medical professionals who will be dealing with this? And I'm particularly referring to the tests that can be done for cognitive ability, especially in aging adults. Is that part of this process?
Chair Reed and Representative McEwen, the vast majority of the recommendations in the work group report had to do with things that can be done outside of the legislation. So, of course, the legislative piece is very small, the immunity piece. But other recommendations had to do with more outreach to medical professionals, more training of medical professionals in terms of what are the standards, what are the ways to interact with your patient in a way that is respectful of the doctor-patient relationship or health provider-patient relationship. It doesn't get you sideways with the patient and the family. That we heard about, or the group heard about, issues involving that, where people become quite upset if they're turned in, even if it's a completely legitimate reason to turn that person in to DMV. So all of those things were discussed. The report gets into those various recommendations, but there's a The program is quite small. It's effectively one person who runs this program, but that is her task now, is to implement those administrative changes, to do that outreach and work with providers to get them to a deeper understanding of what the requirements are and how to interact with their patients.
So there is some support for them understanding the process, I guess, from your perspective.
Chair Reed and Representative McEwen, there is today, and the recommendation was to increase that.
Okay. Follow-up, sir. One other question I have has to do with renewal, license renewal. And we found ourselves in a situation where we had a 90-year-old relative who had her license renewed for 8 years, and we were very concerned about that. And as a family, it was difficult when she came home waving her new license. And we knew that there was going to come a time in the very near future where she was not going to have the ability to properly manage driving. It put us in a very awkward position. And I'm wondering if that has been a part of this conversation.
Chair Reed.
And again, I know it's very sensitive and very difficult. I acknowledge that.
Chair Reed and Representative McEwen, that was a discussion we had hours and hours and hours upon because of the issue of renewal. We consulted a lot of different studies that looked at whether it was a 4-year cycle or an 8-year cycle.
Mm-hmm.
And the conclusion of the committee was that they have to appear and go at the DMV to renew their license after a certain age, and therefore at the process of renewal there is an evaluation that goes on with the DMV folks as they stand there and they do that renewal. And so they might send them on a task to do something, and they might check to see if they can follow the process and stick with it and demonstrate that they have the skills and abilities to maintain that. That was a discussion, and you know, we talked a lot about it, but we did not come out and say that we would recommend that change.
Follow up.
Go ahead.
Brand new lenses when you have cataract surgery make you appear a lot better functioning than maybe you are. Just a little heads up. I think that's all I have for now. I appreciate this conversation. I know this is a really difficult topic, and I appreciate, again, you're treating it with honor and respect. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
It's a tough one.
Ted Leibert.
Thank you. And my direction is kind of similar to what she did. I'm concerned, not that I'm not in favor of this. I think it's absolutely essential, and we should provide immunity so we get more reporting, because unfortunately I've known people that had no business being on the road, but they never got reported. But the part I'm still concerned about is, and you talked some about maybe the outreach to the providers, and that, because as a family member that has elderly parents, that we're going through a situation already, and it's going to come to that. First, it did concern me that they renewed their license for 8 years, because that creates in the minds of the person that got their license renewed, and that causes a problem for the family, let alone for the person. But beside that, if the person, when they report them, and if the family's not involved, because there's this relationship between the doctor and the patient, and I understand that, wanting to be confidential, and the person then finds out from the notification from DMV, it creates another whole level of struggles of how you deal with that. And so I guess I just need a little more understanding about how that process works from the standpoint of working with the providers to try to transition this, because it's a very, very difficult problem for families with any of us getting older.
You want me to do it? Chair Reed and Representative Lively, we had a lot of discussion about this, and I think that the hard part is to broad brush, take an age-related thing and say a 90-year-old mm-hmm. doesn't deserve to have a license when they might be a better driver than some of my 15-year-olds that I work with on the professional level.
Yep.
You know, is it's quite a bit. We just had a lot of discussion about this. Broad brush approach to say everybody has to go through this relicensing process and evaluation or check at these age markers was found to be somewhat it was overreaching, and it tried to address an issue that you might find personal, but that isn't as big an issue for people, other people throughout the community. My dad was a state police officer, and I had to explain to him that I had to, you know, you can't drive anymore. And, you know, he was a big man, and it was like, really? You're going to take my keys away? You know, but the reality was he had to have a crash.
you know, and then he realized that that was going to be, that he wasn't going to drive anymore. So I understand that it would be nice if we had a tool that said, you know what, at this particular time in your life, you've got to give me the keys because you're not going to do it. I think the other piece, too, and I'll finish up here, you know, in Coos Bay, the public transportation issue isn't really benefit. I mean, it's not really available. I live in Portland. I can call TriMet, and I can have somebody pick me up. And we talked a lot about this, that reality-wise, to remove the independence that might exist for aged drivers, or especially the aged drivers, and keep them from the opportunity to live in their home was a real concern. And so that was discussed extensively on this particular work group.
So if I understand this correctly, when the notification is only provided to DMV, what about the person themselves that the notification is being provided about? Are they notified at the same time, or do they find out from DMV?
Chair Reed and Representative Lively, they find out from DMV.
Representative McHugh?
Just another follow-up. In my experience, this conversation occurred in the physician's office with them present, and they were told at that time in a kind of a cloistered setting, which I thought was very appropriate, and then the notification went to the DMV. So I don't know how many physicians are trained in actually going through that process in a way that's manageable and, again, done respectfully. And I think what we want to avoid is some experience that I've had. I was actually broadsided at a stoplight by an 85-year-old woman who they'd been asking not to drive for a long period of time. My father had an accident, which precipitated us having him tested and going through the process. And those are the things that you don't want to happen. And luckily, there wasn't anyone physically harmed. There was a lot of insurance work done. But those are the things that you don't want to have happen. So I guess I'm going to applaud you for your work and understand that this is hard. I think you're on the right track. I think this is a great place to go, but I think we need more work on this issue. Yeah.
I have one that is probably a little unfair and a little outside of the scope of this specific bill, but given your professional expertise, I can't resist. And it'll be quick, I promise. A while ago, we did some work in the 2007 legislature around bike safety, and it occurred to me that it's of little value if drivers don't know that the law has changed. So that led me to wonder about the prospect of asking people to take the written test on renewal, and leaving aside the question of how long renewals are, at what the interval is, and whether that is appropriate to change based on age and that sort of thing. As you interact with aspiring drivers and others, have you seen any? Is there any insight you might offer on that, and the value of taking the written test again? And as we talked about it, I was perfectly fine saying online, open book, but the process of refreshing and being exposed to what changes the legislature might make.
That is an excellent question, and I think we need to look at the entire driving process, that it's knowledge, skills, and attitude that have to come into play here, and knowledge is certainly one piece of that, and our legislature does do a good job of coming with great laws that help manage traffic, help us to interact positively. The biggest thing that we have to work with kids, too, besides knowledge, is the skills and the attitudes that they bring. We can have the best laws in the country, but if they don't have the attitude that they need to obey them, then realistically we have a real problem with that. And that's why we have driver improvement citations that are issued occasionally for those reasons. I think testing, and you're right, I took my driver's test in 1971, okay? And in 1971 there's a lot of different laws that are in place now than there are. And fortunately I teach driving, so it's not a problem, but I can see where some people who got their license in 1955 mm-hmm. might have a little problem with some of the laws because they haven't reviewed them. They don't, and except for the public service announcements that come out. So that would be a great idea.
What'd they do with cell phones?
Representative McEwen.
I'm gonna apologize, but this is dear to my heart, obviously. Do you still have your 55 Alive program? Is that still active in Oregon?
Chair Reed.
That's an AARP program.
It is an AARP, and we had AARP representation on there, and they promoted that during our conversations during the work group. And I've actually done trainings with some of the trainers.
That's a good program, and it does work.
Yes, it does.
Thank you.
Representative Davis?
Yeah, thank you, Chair. I just wanted to follow up with you. As I've been reading the bill a little more closely, I do think the last sentence on the second page covers the situation that I was attempting to address and makes clear that the immunity covers mandatory and non-mandatory reporters, which leads me to my next question of, could you summarize again who is mandatory, who are mandatory reporters now, currently?
Chair Reed, Representative Davis. It's primary care physicians.
Okay.
Primary care providers.
Okay.
And that can include naturopaths.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Parrish.
Well, thank you. That leads my follow-up question. What would trigger, what types of things would trigger that mandatory strokes or, what would cause somebody to be mandatory versus something that would be voluntary if they're both health-related issues?
I can take it.
Please.
Chair Reed, Representative Parrish. It is persistent and debilitating, cognitive, and it can be in cognitive function. It could be in physical function. It depends on, it could be a stroke, but some people who've had a stroke and have a mild hemiplegia can still drive. So it varies with different medical conditions, but it has to be, the bill defines it, and if I can find it again here, as being persistent, uncontrollable. It comes from uncontrollable and goes to impairments that are persistent impairments, which means it might be, if they did have a stroke, that is oftentimes permanent damage, and so therefore couldn't do it. If they have persistent seizures, then that would be recognized by the primary care provider or the neurologist or something of that nature.
Follow-up?
Go ahead.
So those would be the mandatory pieces. What would be things that you would say that they are not already covered under the kind of those types of situations? What types of situations would you envision for a reason to do it voluntarily?
Chair Reed, Representative Parrish, it would be something in the neighborhood of, let's say, a primary care physician in Representative McKeown's place, where they met with the primary care provider or a provider, and the parents and the family were having a discussion with the provider to say, you know what, they're just not driving like the way they should. And it's maybe not a persistent thing, but it's something that they would agree that it would be a good idea to report this and get them off the road.
One more.
Go ahead.
So I wanted to go and say, you know, hey, take my brother off the road. I actually have a brother-in-law who had a stroke. It has left him very debilitated, and he drives. So if I went to his doctor and said, you know, hey, you need to go consider this, what's the DMV's then look at that recommendation from a doctor, and what's the dispute process for the brother-in-law who, while he's very cognitively impaired in the language, can still kind of read the stop signs and the hands work mostly, and, what does that look like?
Chair Reed and Representative Parrish, I mean, the first thing I would say is there is a very extensive administrative rule about all kinds of criteria and that sort of thing. It's not just sort of a wing and a prayer. It seems debilitating. It seems persistent, so we're going to call it that. So there's a lot of rigor to that in the administrative rule. But in terms of the mandatory report, so the primary care physician determines that under all of these standards, I have to, it's my duty, report. So they do report that to DMV. DMV's process at that point is looking at it, making sure, A, the person who's reported it is a primary care physician, because that's the only person covered, and then that it meets those standards. Then the decision is essentially immediate. It's an immediate suspension notice. I think it's like a 5-day, but it's essentially immediate. The person can then ask to have that reviewed. Again, DMV employs medical determination officers who are medical doctors who can review medical records, get recommendations from that person's physician or other physicians, and then DMV can also, if they get sort of a clearance from that medical determination officer that, yes, I think whether it's the condition cleared or maybe the analysis was wrong coming in on the report coming in, would clear that person, and then DMV would subject the person to one or all of the tests that DMV does, vision, knowledge, drive test, to see if the person can reacquire their driving privileges. On the non-mandatory side of things, where it's coming in maybe from a medical professional, maybe from a family member, a law enforcement officer, a person at the DMV window who recognizes that this person really maybe shouldn't be driving, that report comes in, and that is almost never in the immediate suspension kind of thing. It is a letter. You need to come in. You know, you've been identified as maybe needing to be retested. Come in, take some testing, or perhaps so it is less immediate, and almost never is it the suspension without the chance to come in and retest or get checked out. So it's a very different pathway on the mandatory versus the non-mandatory sides.
Can I just, I guess, one more follow-up? I guess why I'm asking is why I think the majority of people who would voluntarily say, you know, Grandma shouldn't be driving anymore and totally above board, well-intentioned, you know, we've worked a lot in the last, particularly in the last session, around some of the elder abuse stuff where you might have potentially a caregiver who uses this as a leverage and control piece mm-hmm. with the person whom they're caring for, essentially stranding them by, you know, driver's license coming away, whether they're impaired or not. And I'm just, my concern is for people who get caught up in, you know, some, that's why we passed an elder abuse law, and we didn't really address DMV issues in that. And I would, my concern kind of goes immediately to somebody who is manipulative around a caregiver with somebody who's of a certain age or disability or what have you.
Chair Reed, Representative Parrish, absolutely. And so that's why on that non-mandatory side of things, the report comes in that the typical path is send a letter to the person and say, you need to come in, you know, set an appointment, come in to DMV within the next 30 days. You're not suspended at that time. You need to come in, do some retesting or whatever. And if you don't come in and do that, you know, if you just blow off the testing ask, then you can be suspended. But so it's the ask to come in, you're not suspended immediately and then have to prove it sort of on the back end.
I guess my concern there is would be, you know, that the letter doesn't actually reach the driver's license holder. And we hear those kind of stories, and they're just really horrific. And so I just want to make sure that we're being thoughtful about inadvertently somebody who gets caught up in that type of situation, and it does happen.
Understood.
So the good news is I think Paul's entry makes it a little bit harder. We've nearly cleared the room. We can ask if anyone else by name wants to be heard on the bill. And I was worried that someone's going to move the previous question. I think we might be ready to go on this bill. So there's no one else signed up to testify. We know all the names of everyone in the room. So we're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2195 and open a work session on House Bill 2195. Representative Benz?
I'm sure move House Bill 2195 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Benz moves House Bill 2195 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? I hope not.
Very short. I hope that as part of the record of our committee work, the comment about looking into how the term healthcare provider will be interpreted mm-hmm. Could be discussed maybe on the Senate side if it passes the House and goes to the Senate. It might be we want to use some words that we've already used in other healthcare legislation, such as physical or behavioral health care or something, if that is what the intent is.
Thank you.
That's it.
Representative Davis, no.
Very good.
Representative Parrish.
Sorry. I'll add that for intent. I mean, I'm hopeful that in the rulemaking process around something like this, that there is some thought given to that piece around, you know, that potential for somebody to abuse that going, you know, so, yeah.
Thank you. Any objections to the motion? I don't see any. The motion carries. House Bill 2195 goes to the floor. We need a carrier. Representative McEwen. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Close the work session on House Bill 2195. And we have one left. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 181. Mr. Chesler,
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, Senate Bill 181 extends maximum term of loans made from the water fund from 25 years to 30 years.
Mr. Chesler.
Pass the Senate 6-0.
6-0?
The committee, perhaps. The
committee, excuse me.
It's a low quorum number.
It's at least 16.
Chair Reed, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Lynn Chester. I'm the director of the Infrastructure Finance Authority, and given the serious nature of your previous discussions, I'm almost embarrassed to bring this bill to you. But
we gave you the chance, Mr. Chester, to reschedule,
but it's okay. We'll be out here by 4:30.
That's a dangerous thing to say to this
committee. I know.
We'll be out here before then.
That's almost like throwing down the gauntlet.
Yeah. Are you sure about that, Mr. Chester? Yeah, my desire would be to have
very good.
Out of here by
4:30. Very good.
Senate Bill 181 proposes a small modification to our water fund statutes. The water fund finances water or wastewater projects statewide to address health or safety issues, and eligible borrowers to that fund are cities, counties, ports, and special districts. I would call this another tool in the toolbox for us. The proposed language provides the option for us to amortize loans for 30 years rather than the current statutory limit of 25 years. Because it's an option, it doesn't mean we're going to use it every time. It's simply an option, and I'll tell you why we're seeking this option. I've been working with my IFA board now for the last several years, and what we're trying to do is affect the least expensive possible way to finance water or wastewater system improvements in the communities. And my board has adopted a three-point strategy on that. The first part is to look at the community's median income and gauge how far that might be below the state's average median income. As a result of gauging how far below that the median income that community's income is, we can adjust the interest rate to as low as 1% in their borrowing. The second part of the strategy is if adjusting the interest rate doesn't get them a decent user rate for their constituents, we can provide a $750,000 grant to them to help subsidize the expense of their system improvement. The third prong that this implements is give us an opportunity to extend the amortization period for another 5 years. Again, a little tool in the toolbox, but if the first two don't work, here's a third that we can implement to basically get them an affordable user rate for their community. And that's as complicated as it is.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions for Mr.
Chair? I just think it's a great idea, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Lively. We appreciate it. Given that we have some time for Senate bills, we're not going to be moving the bill today, but we appreciate the introduction, and I suspect we will be back to it before long. Peggy, you're the last one in the room. Did you have something you wanted to say on the bill? All right. Thank you very much. With that, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 181. And thank you for your attention. We have one more bit of business. Representative Benz.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move the rules be suspended and Representative Harris be allowed to vote on House Bill 2345.
Thank you. Representative Benz moves the rules be suspended and Representative Parrish be allowed to vote on House Bill 2345. Is there any objection? Seeing none, the rule is suspended. Representative Parrish, how do you vote?
I vote aye, and thank you for letting me do that.
Thank you. Representative Parrish votes aye. And unless there's anything else to come before the committee, have a good in-district day on Friday. See you on Monday.
I'll see you tomorrow.